InvestorIdeas.com podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of InvestorIdeas.com podcast. In today's podcast, we take a look at Oklahoma's rejection of recreational cannabis, roadside testing in Australia, and issues surrounding roadside testing in legal cannabis jurisdictions, and the continued use of outdated cannabis stigmas in the media and in North America. In recent news, Oklahoma rejected a new ballot intended to bring recreational cannabis to the state. A state which currently has a growing medical cannabis industry rejected the recent ballot question that would have allowed dispensaries across the state to sell cannabis to anyone over the age of 21. The proposal was widely opposed by law enforcement, school administrators, and political and faith leaders. Currently, about 10% of the adult population now has a medical license, but the program has been plagued by illegal growers, headline-grabbing crimes, and a deluge of out-of-state consumers. Pat McFerrin, an advisor to the 820 campaign, said that the vote sends a clear message that Oklahomans oppose the unfettered access to marijuana that they have experienced under the so-called medical program. Oklahoma is a law and order state, added Governor Kevin Stitt, a Republican who also opposed the measure. He vowed to continue to hold bad actors accountable and crack down on illegal marijuana operations. Today's decision in Oklahoma is heartbreaking, especially considering how many challenges this bill faced before it got to the ballot and how much work advocates put in, said Jeffrey M. Zucker, who is the co-founder and president of Denver-based cannabis consultancy Green Lion Partners and a vice chair of the board at the Marijuana Policy Project, which is a national legislation advocacy group. We have a long way to go under the damage of the war on drugs, especially in a state where more than 4,500 people are arrested annually for cannabis possession, he added. Now, last November, similar cannabis referendums were approved in Maryland and Missouri, but rejected in Arkansas, North Dakota, and South Dakota. So, when we're looking at Oklahoma, the medical industry has gotten a lot of attention over the last couple of years. Because of the potential of the population, obviously a state with sort of a heavy conservative outlook when you're looking at cannabis, it was a big move when they did allow for a medical program, but now the state is having difficulties with the illicit market growing as you allow for the medical program, and they kind of keep pointing to states like California as an example of how, as you allow more cannabis licensing and you extend your reach with cannabis legislation, the illicit market does grow within that environment instead of shrink. Now, there's a lot of other factors contributing to California's illicit market other than just allowing for more cannabis licensing. A big issue is access to that licensing, the cost of business licenses, the cost of basically setting up your infrastructure, and as well the taxation that goes into that. So realistically, California could have less of an illicit market if they addressed some of these issues, but they haven't. And then again, in that market, you have seen the illicit market grow exponentially. So for a lot of these states like Oklahoma, again, for, you know, Arkansas, North Dakota, and South Dakota, and any other state that's hesitant about recreational access or expanding cannabis legislation, this is basically the number one complaint, is that as you allow for more cannabis legality within your state, you do open up avenues for illicit companies or illicit projects to come into the state and operate with, you know, less hesitancy than they would if the state had a complete no-go policy towards cannabis. You know, at the end of the day, there's a lot of different factors that are addressing this, but I do think that it is somewhat heartbreaking to see that this is another time that this has been rejected and that there still is this heavy cannabis stigma that exists in many parts of the world today and many states still in America. Because, again, people only want to see the one side of the industry. When they hear cannabis, many of them still look at the illegal component of it. They see crime. They see drug dealers. Instead of seeing medicine, instead of seeing something that dramatically improves the society that it interacts with, instead of seeing a change in the overall life of people within that environment. And unfortunately, it's very difficult to change people's minds on certain things. I think that this will probably be a ballot issue that gets raised again in Oklahoma in the next couple of years. I do think that it'll probably be a while before they move to any recreational program. I do think there's also benefits to staying in the medical program and not allowing recreational access, which I have talked about before in this podcast, in that when you see recreational come in, you do see damage that gets sort of unintended to the medical programs that exist in that same area. And this is just simply because there's more profit and more short-term money to be made in the recreational market than there is in the medical market. Now, over the long term, we have seen some of the issues with this as well. Aurora recently just had a great article that they did with MJ Biz Daily, where they did talk about the benefits for them as a company in transitioning back to medical and away from recreational within the Canadian market and internationally, in that the medical market is more guaranteed when you're looking at sales. So from a business perspective, there's a lot of advantages. And also from a PR perspective, there's a lot more simplicity to working with the medical market. It's a lot easier to gain good press and good attention from the public as well as from, you know, the industry as a whole. People do enjoy the medical program more. That's what's getting the attention to the cannabis industry to begin with. That's what really started this grassroots movement, is medical access. So at the end of the day, it's not a huge loss for the industry that they didn't go to recreational, because there are issues when you look at expanding recreational access in different states and different jurisdictions. Not just that this could potentially boost the illicit market, but again, this could potentially hamper your medical market or change some of the factors in the states or how businesses operate. And this is simply because, again, every time we see recreational come in, you see medical go down somewhat. And it's just because of where the profit's at for a lot of these businesses. And also, it's a lot less restrictive when you're looking at how you have to package things, the quality of your product, the sort of way you're looked at under a microscope when you're in a medical market. Obviously, people take medicine much more seriously than they take recreational products. So there's a lot less scrutiny that you're under when you're in a recreational market, especially if you're in a very open recreational market like in California. So as I said, there's some legitimacy and sort of benefits to Oklahoma maintaining as a medical state. And I do think that when you're looking at recreational expansion, you have to see some more success in states like Colorado and California, where you don't see the industry sort of run wild and work along with illicit markets. Again, there's a lot of issues. There's a few interviews we've done recently where we did talk directly about the California market and the different pieces of legislation that sort of need to change if that market's going to survive and if a lot of these businesses can continue to grow. And also if you can continue to convince people who are illicit operators to then be able to transition into the legal market. A lot of those things are different factors to consider. So I do think that until you see a more successful system within California, almost anyone, whether you're looking at different states or different countries in the world which are looking at recreational programs, can kind of point to California as an example of why not to move into recreational, which is disheartening to some extent, but again, very validated by the actual reality of cannabis businesses suffering within the California market. And similarly within the Canadian market, we've seen that recreational companies have not done as well in certain areas. We've seen the large LPs really struggle, report loss after loss. And people can point to those as examples, and that's kind of always going to be the case until we see some real headwinds in the cannabis industry. Again, if you look at Trulieve's recent financials, they did see a good profitability within the last year. They are moving in the right direction, but not enough companies are following them in that same direction. And you're not seeing that as an industry trend overall in different jurisdictions. There's a lot of people who are still struggling. And a lot of this does come down to sloppy legislation at the end of the day. It's not necessarily that there's no demand. There's huge demand for cannabis in every market that it gets opened up into. And there's a huge amount of sales to be made. There's a lot of people interested in growing. There's a huge amount of jobs that get created. But at the same time, if every time you always have these sort of complicated legislative hurdles that are going to slow people down, that are going to deny people access, that are going to make it difficult for the industry to expand organically, then it's going to be justified when people say that they reject that idea. Now, in other news coming from Australia, Victoria's drug driving laws are set to be overhauled for medical cannabis users, with both major parties backing a push by legalized cannabis over the unfair rules. Now, debate on the Road Safety Amendment, the medical cannabis bill, introduced by the newly elected legalized cannabis MPs, was adjourned on Wednesday after the government committed to addressing the issue within the months. Now, the bill seeks to change the state's road safety laws to treat medical cannabis like other prescription medications for drivers. Currently, it is an offense for a person to drive with any trace of THC in their system, even if they have a prescription from their doctor. Now, the Labor MP Harriet Shing, who is a member of the Medical Cannabis and Safe Driving Working Group established by the government, said finding a distinction between presence of THC and impairment was a significant priority. Now, this work has been going on for a number of years now, and the working group has actually discussed at length the complexities of this matter and the options and opportunities that might be available, she told the Upper House on Wednesday. We need to find a way through all of this so that all drivers are able to be safe on our roads and so that we can provide those medical supports that Victorians need and indeed deserve. Now, the opposition leader in the Upper House, Matt Bock, said that the coalition viewed the current system as unfair and inconsistent, with 65,000 Victorians currently prescribed for medical cannabis. Now, this has been an issue raised in many U.S. states with the medical programs, as well as in Canada since federal legalization. One of the key issues, which I've discussed many different times when you're looking at driving impairment with cannabis, is that the specifics surrounding roadside testing and the accuracy of the various equipment being used are not as bulletproof as we would like to think. How THC is absorbed in the body and the length of time it stays in your system is a big factor, as well as this is a medical product that's being prescribed for a variety of medical conditions, some of which are necessary to go to work, unlike alcohol or other drugs which are tested for on the road. So really, again, it's a good thing to see that Australia and the state of Victoria is moving in the right direction to actually address these issues, but they're going to come up to a lot of real problems that it turns out nobody so far has successfully navigated or figured out a way to sort of fairly administer, because when you're looking at cannabis testing roadside, there's a lot of different things that come into play. One of the biggest things at the moment is that essentially all of the equipment, whether you're looking at breathalyzers or blood tests, is wildly inaccurate, and it's coming from a variety of different companies that have really randomized success rates. There's been a lot of issues. I've looked at a lot of the different companies and products that are coming onto the market. A lot of the police who are using them are not very well trained in how to use these or how to administer these roadside tests. The roadside testing devices are expensive, so actually police are hesitant to use them because of the cost associated with actually doing a roadside test. So a lot of times what you're seeing happen is it's actually just the police officer's best judgment and the person just goes along with it. This is very similar to getting a speeding ticket without actually being hit by the speedometer or a radar gun. You know, cops driving at the same pace as you, they say, well, I know you were speeding. Well, unless they actually catch you with a radar gun and have proof in the pudding that you were speeding, you can debate those tickets and you can often win. The same is going on with cannabis roadside tests. There's a lot of times it's simply that the officer smells cannabis within the vehicle or smells it coming from the driver and then is offering the ticket. They're not actually administering the roadside test often. And again, even in the moments where they do, there's a reliability factor that goes into play with these devices. And many times these cannabis tickets have actually been won in court by the drivers because of these issues. So it's kind of a big waste of time currently at the moment. And the people who are paying these tickets are really just the people who are kind of scared into believing that they're not going to win if they go and fight this in court. But any of the people who have actually often won because of the inaccuracy of the equipment, because a lot of the time it's actually just the police officer's judgment not actually having evidence. And a lot of the time, even the times where the person is, you know, basically proven guilty, it's because the person admits to it themselves and just says, I admit to having cannabis in my system, and that admission alone is enough to basically justify the ticket. So there's not really any good option that's available at the moment, whether you're looking at anywhere in North America or anywhere else in the world, to actually do these roadside tests. And then another big issue is just THC itself as a substance. So even if you can accurately detect THC within the body, there's no way really at all to detect when this THC was absorbed within the system. And that can go to even large amounts. So a big problem is that THC is absorbed through fat. And because of that, people of different body weights are going to store THC for longer. People of different sexes, so men tend to store more THC than women. People who are using workout supplements or tend to be doing a lot of heavy working out can actually store more THC in their system. And there's a lot of different factors that need to be considered there of what is a impairment level for which type of body weight, because when we're looking at blood alcohol content, it's actually quite simple to measure where an intoxication level stands. With THC, there isn't really a measurement that we have sort of universally agreed upon, and again, different people's body styles and structures is going to dramatically change the amount of THC they can safely consume when there is no impairment. And then again, you're also looking at, was that recently consumed or was that consumed a week ago? Because THC can last in your system for up to 90 days on average. And so when you're comparing this to alcohol, when you're comparing this to crack and cocaine, and really any other drug that exists on the market, almost all of those can be detoxed out of your system within a very short amount of time. Cannabis, on the other hand, cannot be. So I've talked about the fact that many of the truckers within Canada and the US, we've lost something like 150,000 in all of North America because they've tested positive for cannabis in their system and then aren't reapplying for their road licenses. Or finding other work or finding, you know, different companies to go with. But because of this, there's a huge amount of drivers not on the road. And it also, it's a lot of these drivers are actually using medical cannabis to deal with the pains and the aches that come from doing this job. So again, that's another big problem, is we're not just talking about a recreational product like alcohol, which has no medical prescription and no medical side to it. We're talking about actual medical products. And a lot of the jobs that are going to be attributed with medical products from cannabis are the very jobs that are going to have these drug tests and roadside tests on a regular basis. So even when you're just looking at drug screening for any federal employee, a lot of these federal employment jobs are, you know, labor jobs or simplistic jobs with repetitive motions in them. And those are a lot of the jobs that people get cannabis prescriptions for because of the aches, because of the pains, because of the disabilities that come from working within those job fields. So it's a very confusing, weird thing to try to deal with. There's a few companies that have started coming up with very short-term analyzers of cannabis that can test for THC within the last 24 hours. Some have gotten down to 12 hours. Those 12-hour products so far, though, have had a little bit of inaccuracy within their testing and some of the early data that's come out. So again, there still isn't this magic product that can sort of actually and realistically detect when you smoked weed and if you are impaired in the moment. It's very much still just in the officer's judgment in the moment, and then there's a lot of issues with that because, again, police also have a lot of cannabis stigmas that have been very deeply ingrained into them from arresting people for this and basically being the main, you know, opponents of cannabis for decades. And so it's very difficult as well to untrain that stigma and that bias from police officers who have been working, you know, to deal with people and pull people over and arrest people for possession and all these things for many, many years, are now suddenly having to treat this as a medical product, which is a very different way for them to deal with things. And realistically, there is no other product that's really out there that's like this. There's not a lot of other prescription medications that can cause impairment to this level that we allowed. One of the weird things is, you know, when you're looking at prescription opioids, there's a lot of issues there when you're looking at road safety, because again, a huge amount of truck drivers are on prescription opiates, and they are very much related and linked to a lot of driving accidents that have happened and a lot of impaired driving. You don't hear about that as much, and you don't hear about the difficulties when you're looking at that same environment. So there's a lot of questions that'll be going into place here for Victorians to try to address this issue. But I think it is inspiring to see that more parts of the world are actually looking at doing something about this, and at least it's on the minds of legislators and politicians that this is an actual issue that does need to be addressed. And speaking of cannabis stigmas, that's going to kind of be what I finish with today, which is the continuation of outdated stigmas or unfounded research that continues to perpetuate within news outlets, and how these so-called news stories continue to avoid the much more serious issues caused by alcohol use, tobacco use, refined sugars, and traditional pharmaceutical medications. It takes only a brief search on any search platform, most notoriously Google, to find a variety of news articles and pseudo-studies discussing the dangers of cannabis use and the unknowns of cannabis use, outdated stigmas, and anti-cannabis propaganda. So, just on today and yesterday's Google search, if you just were to type in cannabis on Google and go to news, you'd come across, within many of the positive articles, still a handful of articles that are pushing some very nonsensical things. So, long-term cannabis use, cognitive decline in the hippocampus, from Psychology Today, which was an article which implies a direct correlation between cannabis use and cognitive decline, but it does offer none of the original data, underplays the fact that most of this data is obtained from interviews, and does not include the cross-reference data from the control groups, which were people with alcohol consumption, people with tobacco consumption, and other substances. And there's a lot of this discussion over and over again. You always hear that long-term cannabis use can lead to cognitive decline. It seems like that is mostly anecdotal, because when you're looking at medical cannabis use, which has been around now in some states for quite some time, where's that cognitive decline en masse? Especially when you're looking at a large-scale medical patient group that you have access to and have continued long-term data on, you would see some sort of downside slide in all those control groups. You don't see that. Similarly, when you're looking at cannabis research that's come out of Israel, which has over 60 years of data, you don't see any of this link to cognitive decline. These are people who are actually monitoring people's brains on a fucking constant basis because they want to show how cannabis interacts with the mind. Somehow, those groups have not shown any link with cognitive decline. And then there's the reality that we always hear over and over again of, if teenagers or youth smoke cannabis, that it'll, you know, impair their functions, impair their development. And if that's true, then anecdotally, we would see a huge problem from basically everyone who lived through the 60s and 70s. This was a time where a vast majority of North Americans were smoking weed, and yet somehow that's also the same generation that has developed most of the businesses we deal with today, and is where most of the members of government that exist in all of North America come from today. So that, to me, is a difficult sort of thing to even try to propose, even anecdotally. You would need to provide a huge data set to actually support that. And what's interesting is, again, we do have huge data sets to go off of. We have huge medical patient rosters to deal with, where you could look at direct links between cognitive decline, but you just don't see that. And again, none of these articles or supposed new studies use any of that data or work with any of these medical operators to actually obtain their data, because at the end of the day, I think that they very much know that what they're saying is a bunch of crap. There was also an article, National Survey Reveals More Than One-Third of U.S. Women Consume Cannabis But Stigmas Linger, from the Financial Post, which openly discussed how even though a large percentage of women admit to cannabis use privately, social stigmas keep them from admitting this openly, especially when you're looking at moms. This has been a thing that I've talked about before. Yesterday was International Women's Day, so of course this article was quite relevant. And the reality is that this is an issue that very much persists when you're looking at cannabis use all throughout the world, is that one of the biggest groups that will be the most hesitant about discussing their cannabis use is going to be women, and specifically women who have children, because of the actual real fear that they could be seen as an unfit parent for their cannabis use. And even though there is nothing linking that there's actually a lot of benefits to parents having cannabis use when it comes to dealing with their children, when it comes to dealing with some of the stresses of being a parent, and actually when it comes to pregnancy and a lot of the issues that pregnant women face when it comes to inflammation, when it comes to diet, when it comes to overall stress and anxiety, there's actually a lot of benefits to cannabis. And again, there will be pseudo studies that have come out that talk about how cannabis use affects embryo development, but again, we would have seen some sort of large impact moment that actually any of these studies could have gone off of when you're looking at tons of people who were born in the 60s and 70s, tons of people who were born to hippie parents. It turns out we don't see this huge impairment group. We don't see this large cognitive decline group from anybody. So where is that big group of people out there? Because this has been a drug that people have been exposed to for a long ass time. And you could say, well, that's been illegal cannabis and it was different or whatever. But the reality is that, again, we just don't see this sort of, you know, smoking gun of evidence that exists that shows that people who have been exposed to this drug are actually having a negative effect from it. There was also another article, rise in people using cannabis to treat health conditions, but doctors warn patients are putting themselves at risk. From Sky News, which discusses how as more people continue to use cannabis in the UK, doctors warn users of the risks of illicit cannabis, even though while cannabis users can admit to themselves for the hospital for some sort of overdose or anything, there actually has been no reported overdoses of cannabis, a drug which has been connected to human culture for thousands of years. So you always hear these stories when you want to look for anti-cannabis PR and propaganda. Of children were admitted to the hospital, or this person was admitted to the hospital for a cannabis overdose. Now, what these articles often fail to really discuss in more detail is the fact that nothing actually happens. So when you have these greening out moments and these people are freaking out and they think they're having a heart attack and they think they're having a panic attack and they think they're having this and they think they're dying, they're just very high. And when they go to the hospital, there's no drug that they administer to them. And this has actually been some of the issues, is sometimes people have mistakenly thought that people were being admitted to the hospital for a real drug overdose, and they've given them the product that they would do for a fentanyl overdose, for instance. And that product, if you're given it without opiates in your system, can actually cause you problems. So some of the real problems that have come from supposed cannabis overdoses have been actually the treatment of treating it like it's a real overdose, when in reality, all you have to do is just sit there and let the person just eventually level out. And basically saying that there's no reason to take people to the hospital for a cannabis overdose doesn't really comfort parents. It doesn't really comfort the average person who's freaking out. So a lot of people, what we find is as you get more high THC products in a market, some people, just basically overdo it. And they tend to buy products that are too high of a dose for them, and then they freak out. And then they go to the hospital in a big panic, thinking that they're going to die. But the reality is all they get administered at the hospital is an IV drip of water and told to relax. And at the end of the day, like I said, there are no actual real reported cannabis overdoses. And that's with a long, long history of cannabis use and a large, large amount of people who have been using this substance. So if you're looking to find articles which show more realistic studies that have been conducted for both long-term and short-term and have much larger study groups to go off of and discuss the vast potential of cannabis in reducing opiate addiction or overdoses, alcoholism, as well as anxiety, inflammation, and depression, fortunately, again, you'll always have to go to cannabis-devoted sources like MJ Biz Daily, Marijuana Moment, and Herb, just to name a few. Now, it would be easy to argue that there are biases on both sides of this argument, but the difference here is the fear-mongering surrounding cannabis is widely, if not entirely, unfounded. So you could say that there are risks associated with cannabis, but you could also say that there's risks associated with peanuts. In fact, there are more risks associated with peanuts or coconuts than there are with cannabis. So some of these things that you could look at as far as comparing facts would be pharmaceutical products like prescription opiates, which in 2021 had 16,706 deaths reported that were associated with opiate-related deaths. Alcohol, which is linked to more than 140,000 people, approximately 97,000 men and 43,000 women, are related to deaths from alcohol-related causes annually. When you're looking at refined sugars, specifically in beverage products from companies like Coca-Cola and Pepsi, which a new Harvard School of Public Health research suggests that roughly 180,000 obesity-related deaths worldwide, including 25,000 Americans, are associated with the consumption of sugary drinks. When you compare this to cannabis, it actually has more data that suggests that cannabis use appears to prevent approximately 17,400 to 38,500 premature deaths annually under the current policies, and it would have an estimated 23,000 or 47,000 deaths which could be prevented annually if medical marijuana were legal nationwide. So again, when you're saying that cannabis has risks associated with it, there are actual products on the market that kill up to 140,000 people a year. There's no issues with those products going onto the market. They are legal products. They have warning labels on them. That's about the amount of scrutiny that they have to go under. At the same time, there is data that 100% suggests that cannabis, when it comes into markets and comes as a medical program, actually prevents deaths, up to 50,000 deaths a year. So that's 50,000 people a year who could be saved from having cannabis legalization worldwide. This factual reality may seem impossible for a lot of people to believe, but the actual reality is that, you know, alcohol, pharmaceutical products, some of which are being recommended for off-label use, such as in the recent news surrounding Ozempic, and refined sugar products are allowed to be advertised nationally, if not globally, included on programming which minors can view when you're looking at ads on the Super Bowl or just daytime TV, and are endorsed by government officials and regulatory bodies such as the FDA and the CDC. When looking at these facts and the transparent hypocrisy surrounding cannabis when compared to other legal substances, it's very hard to not ask yourself what the hell's going on here, because it seems like if you're just looking at these death numbers and the associations with each of these products, it looks like people are in favor of more people dying every year. And so as a government official, when you're discussing cannabis legalization, when you're discussing expansion of these programs, these should be the facts and statistics that they're talking about very openly, because realistically, who is in favor of more people dying and less people being saved every year? And the reality is that we constantly always have the comparison of cannabis to alcohol, and there's some, you know, common sense to that, in that both of them can be used as recreational products and both of them really can act as a social lubricant in many ways. But the much harsher truth of it all is that we've just fucked up as far as how the world views alcohol should be how we view cannabis currently, and how we view alcohol currently is how we should view cannabis, in that everyone should be very comfortable and normal when they think about, I've turned 19, or I've turned 21, or I've turned of a legal consent age within my jurisdiction of the world, I'm going to enjoy cannabis. This is a social product I can enjoy out in the street, I can enjoy with my friends, I can go to a cannabis bar. This is normal. People should actually be very hesitant about their exposure to alcohol. When you look at alcoholism and the links to alcoholism and emergency room admissions, links to alcoholism and domestic violence, links to alcoholism and suicide, links to alcoholism and just overall body and organ failure, there is some terrifying real facts to be discussed. When you're looking at the percentages of alcohol products, they have increased dramatically over the years, and we don't seem to view that as a massive problem. Again, you can go to any liquor store and buy yourself enough alcohol to kill yourself, quite legally, quite easily, with little scrutiny from anybody. Whereas it is impossible to consume, and I would say, people could say, well, there could always be a level that could kill you with THC. It just hasn't happened yet. There's people who have smoked insane amounts of weed, and even brag about it, and none of them have died from this supposed THC overdose. It just doesn't seem possible. We have an endocannabinoid system. So are we ever going to see a cannabis overdose? Probably not. But we are going to see thousands upon thousands of people dying from alcohol-related deaths every year. We're going to see thousands of people dying from opiate-related deaths every year. We're going to see thousands of people dying from goddamn sugar products. And yet, those products get basically a free pass in our society and are viewed with just open endorsement from government agencies, from ad agencies, from massive corporations. I mean, when you look at this recent FTX scandal, you had Larry David and Tom Brady and a multitude of celebrities and high-end businessmen supporting an open, idiotic scam. They knew little to nothing about the guy who was running this cryptocurrency exchange. They knew little to nothing about cryptocurrencies itself. You know, Sam Mowers, my coworker, he does an amazing job with the Crypto Corner and the AI podcast. But in reality, we know less about AI and cryptocurrency, and there has been more scams involved with both of those issues than there has been with wheat. There's more real danger as far as people supporting those types of things than there is with supporting cannabis. Yet we have far less people endorsing cannabis. We have far less celebrities and legitimate businesses jumping into the cannabis industry because of all the restrictions surrounding the investment in cannabis and because of all the financial restrictions associated with the industry. Yet there is proof in the pudding that this is a medical product that is life-saving for a vast number of people. When you're looking at autistic children and children with epilepsy and who have seizures on a constant basis, this is a miracle drug for them. When you're looking at cancer patients, this is a miracle drug for them. When you're looking at old people with arthritis, when you're looking at athletes dealing with injuries and wanting to improve their physical performance, cannabis can perform an amazing variety of beneficial things to humanity, not just socially, but also medically. And then when you're looking at the potential of hemp, which I've talked about a lot, for our environment, it's just through the roof. And that's something that never gets discussed when you're looking at the cannabis legalization issue, is that the main reason to support open cannabis legalization, where there is little to no scrutiny on this industry, is to get hemp at an industrial scale involved in our society, because that could change the game for plastics, for textiles, for waste management, and for a variety of things, even just paper products, which kill millions of trees every year. And we could get rid of that entire industry by replacing it with hemp, where we would have an environmentally sustainable option for printing books, for printing paper, and the paper is more durable and lasts longer. So there's really no downside to it other than the fact that right now you need a very expensive license to run a hemp cultivation business. And so there's no real incentive for people to have industrialized hemp. That's why you need a more open cannabis policy. And it needs to go to the point where it turns out just anyone can run a legal cannabis business. It needs to be treated like tomatoes, which I've mentioned many times, in that tomatoes still have regulations around them. You still want to buy a product that has proper packaging, that explains the ingredients, that has proper testing, that comes from a farm that's legitimate. You know, when you go to a farmer's market, many of the people who are selling in that farmer's market still have a business license. They still have labels on their products. They still have an accurate assessment of what you are buying. And I think that's all we really need. And that's all we need would be from, you know, basic food safety standards or basic just cultivation standards and packaging standards. What you don't need is to have all of these weird legal loopholes which discourage a huge amount of people from entering into this industry and continue to prop up a criminal market. So it's crazy when you look at all this stuff, and I've talked about it many times, and it exhausts my mind to find that people still refuse to have this discussion like adults. But at the end of the day, this is what you need to look at the long-term investing in cannabis, is that the reality is this is basically a miracle product that will eventually be adopted globally. There's no way around it unless people just decide to go insane and reject all science or reject all logic in the future, which is a possibility. But currently, this is the product that's going to fundamentally change a massive amount of our society over a long period of time. And so, yes, there are a lot of difficulties when it comes to investing properly within the cannabis industry. There's a lot of stock manipulation. There's a lot of garbage going on that, unfortunately, you can't get rid of at the moment. But this is why, if you are an investor in the cannabis industry, you need to be an advocate for pushing these products. And you need to have these types of facts at the ready. And you need to have the discussion around hemp and the utility of it as a textile and a plastic alternative and an oil alternative. You know, hemp oil could replace rapeseed oil and canola oil, which have huge problems associated with them, not only dietarily, but also environmentally. And again, if we were looking at the entire continent of South America, we could be replacing hemp in a lot of these areas where we have canola farms or we have palm oil farms, and it would be much more environmentally sustainable. You'd get a higher yield, a higher crop output with multiple grow cycles each year. You could grow it outdoors, you can grow it indoors vertically. You can do so many more things with hemp as a product, and it turns out it grows so well, it's literally called weed. So at the end of the day, this is going to be a long-term benefit for humanity, but you're going to need to keep having these discussions. And when you're looking at what to invest in or how to invest within this industry, you do still need to be thinking extremely long term. And so some of the companies that are focusing on medical, some of the companies that are focusing on long term strategies are definitely the companies to look at, because this is a long term game. And the reality is it's going to be a long term success story, but there's still so much stupidity in the way. And these are the type of statistics that need to be reported consistently and talked about on a daily basis from not just cannabis-focused outlets, but from mainstream media. And when we see that start to integrate into mainstream media, then we'll know that cannabis is heading in the right direction. That's all for today's podcast. Enjoy the rest of your day. That's all for today's podcast. Podcast is now a certified word trademark on the blockchain through Cognate Incorporated CM certification. InvestorIdeas.com podcasts are also available on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play Music, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and TuneIn. If you'd like to be a guest or sponsor of this podcast, please contact InvestorIdeas.com. Investor Ideas reminds all listeners to read our disclaimers and disclosures on the InvestorIdeas.com website, and this podcast is not an endorsement to buy products or services or securities. Investors are reminded that all investments involve risk and possible loss of investment. Investor Ideas does not condone the use of cannabis except where permissible by law. Our site does not possess, distribute, or sell cannabis products.